Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté. Joining me is Richard Sakwa. He is professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent. His books include Frontline Ukraine, Crisis in the Borderlands, and his latest, Deception, Russiagate and the New Cold War. Richard Sakwa, good to see you again.
Welcome.
It's been a while since we spoke on Pushback about what's going on in Ukraine. So I'm just wondering at this point, your assessment of where we're at when it comes to the war inside Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the first thing to say is a short assessment of the military situation. Obviously, I'm no military expert, but quite clearly, the talk of Ukrainian victory, with almost a smell of victory, almost seems to be in the air. And that was obviously because the Kharkov offensive in September, the offensive now around Kherson, which had been promised throughout the summer, is actually taking place. However, I think that this gave certain illusions of the fact that ultimately Russia was on the run. This certainly is not the case. We do know that there's the partial mobilization announced on the 21st of September. I mean, the word partial is conditional because quite clearly through that announced 300,000 reservists to be called up. You know, maybe more, maybe less. So far, they're saying that the actual mobilization is complete, 240,000. By the time they're trained, not necessarily sent to the front, some will be, of course, but they will be able to take back positions, certainly perhaps in particular in the Far East. And there's plenty of forces which Russia then could move over to the Western Front. So we are anticipating a major Russian offensive once the ground freezes. At the moment, of course, there is an offensive around in Donetsk, around Bakhmut, and that part of the world. So the military balance is unclear, that the idea for a Ukrainian victory, but of course, their ambitions now are, and in fact, both sides are unclear what their end game is. On the Ukrainian side, of course, we have two important developments. The first one is the radicalization of the demand, that the goal is not just to push Russia back to where it was the day before the 24th of February invasion, but also to liberate, as I'd say, deoccupy the Donetsk and indeed Crimea. So that is obviously an important fact. And the second one is three major events: the assassination of Darya Dugina. Of course, the target was her father, Alexander Dugin, the great, as it were, scourge of the West. The second thing is the explosions on the Nord Stream pipeline, which are absolutely extraordinary. The idea, and I've heard senior British officials threaten to eat their hat if it wasn't Russia responsible for it. Well, I'm afraid that these officials will be having a diet of hat, because it's quite clear that Russia would not blow up its own pipelines. Interestingly enough, the very day it took place, there appear to have been negotiations between Germany and Russia on perhaps, not immediately opening the pipelines, but some sort of pathway towards that. I mean, who knows what was actually stated. And of course, the third thing is the attack on the Kerch bridge to Crimea.
It's amazing how quickly things move, that it's easy to forget now that somebody blew up the Nord Stream pipelines, a major international act of sabotage with far-reaching consequences. And now it's barely discussed because there's not much interest, at least in the Western world, to find out really who did it. And so many other things just keep happening. This war keeps escalating. Let me ask you about...
Can I just say one more thing on that? And that is that, the specific act, clearly, as you say, it's moved on. The agenda seems to have moved on, even though, just the physical act itself was quite extraordinary, because it takes a lot of dynamite, a lot of explosive, and a lot of technology to do it. So it was major state actor was almost certainly involved. I'm not going to point the finger now, but as I'm sure we all have our suspicions. But the larger point I wanted to make is what this tells us about Germany and Germany in the new Europe. Because clearly this was an attack on Germany. Its flexibility, I'm not saying it was going to open these pipelines soon, but certainly now the option, well, there's one line out of the four, can potentially be used. But it has reduced Germany. And of course, it has huge economic consequences. And of course, it is the end of 50 years of German engagement with Russia on the energy front, which is in an extraordinary way. Now, this has been extraordinarily beneficial for both sides. And yet the United States, of course, from the very beginning, back in the 1980s, was opposed to it. Well, they've finally achieved their goal. What it tells us then even larger about European Union and its own ability to articulate its own needs outside and above, but not against, of course, the larger Western alliance.
What do you
think? Ooh, my patchouli's wearing off.
Oh, my favorite shirt is ruined.
Humans.
Whoa. You smell amazing.
Thanks. It's Native. Clean, simple, effective deodorant. It's not a myth. It's Native.
Take me to the ocean. Take me to the sea. Let my soul be wet.
What do you think happened to Germany? Angela Merkel oversaw the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Germany committed to doing it, promised Russia that they would see it through, even in the face of U.S. pressure. Angela Merkel leaves and Olaf Scholz comes in, and you find him standing next to Joe Biden in early February. And that's when Biden declares that if Russia invades Ukraine, then we will stop Nord Stream 2 no matter what. And he's asked by a reporter, well, how can you do that if it's not in your territory? And Biden says, you know, trust me, we'll find a way. And he's saying that right next to the German chancellor. How did Germany go from, you know, enthusiastically being a partner in Nord Stream 2 to watching it being sabotaged and not saying anything and actually openly participating in it?
Yeah. I mean, initially, Scholz demurred. And then, you know, within 24 hours, his position changed radically. And he went along with the Biden line. Of course, in part, that's a function of the coalition dynamics, because obviously he's, I was going to say shackled, but allied with the Greens, who have always been, well, both for the energy transition issues, of course, they want to see carbon reduction, but they are particularly, the tradition of the Greens has been very strongly, militantly even anti-Russian for various reasons, and some good ones, including human rights issues, but also bad ones, which I would argue a certain geopolitical naivety, and of course the other Free Democrat partners. And of course, Scholz's inexperience as chancellor, though he's a very experienced leader, as formerly in Hamburg. Yeah, indeed, it's a thing. And of course, you could say this was a delayed time bomb because of Merkel's failure to resolve the larger issue. And one could theoretically sort of say, look, we're all suffering today from the Ukrainization of Western politics. I don't mean that abusively. I just simply technically wants to say that, you know, this whole context, this whole issue has led to a certain extremism, which was already apparent within the model of Ukrainian state formation, already from 91, but even later, the Western Ukrainians militantly anti-Russian. And there seems to be no limit to their demands, which, of course, is very odd that Washington should be, as it were, in hock to these demands, as if Kiev's concerns and interests and national interests are 100% aligned with those of the United States. Of course, you could say it's the other way around, and the United States is driving it as well. But we're into this escalatory cycle, and Germany is the victim. And of course, all of Western Europe is the victim to it, not just energy, but food. And ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, political autonomy. European Union has been transformed by this conflict. It has become now, and is effectively becoming, a military alliance, which is exactly opposite what we, and me personally, over the years was always in favour of the European Union as a peace project, as a way of overcoming the logic of conflict on the European continent. And what that's why, after 1989, I was always saying, well, you've managed to make war between France and Germany almost inconceivable. Well, do the same now, guys, with Moscow, with Russia. You've got the challenge. Russia's receptive. I've just been reading, and I'm at the moment reading Philip Short's magnificent biography of Putin, in which he reminds us and gives us the full text, well, larger text, of the David Frost interview with Putin in March 2000, where Putin begins by saying, you know, that he finds it inconceivable for Russia to be not part of what, of Western civilization. First, second, ask, can Russia join NATO? He said, and why not? But went on to say, as long as it was treated as an equal partner and all of that sort of language. And we've moved from there to where Europe was, you know, ready and open to, well, we were all open to a positive peace agenda to where we are today in a very dangerous hot war.
When you spoke about the Ukrainization of Western politics, can you speak more about the plurality inside of Ukraine and how Western policy basically seeks to erase it and the Ukrainian people as defined by Western politicians is essentially just one contingent inside of Ukraine, the nationalists who you spoke about, and how the U.S. has exploited that to pursue its own goals inside of Ukraine to basically use it as a proxy against Russia?
Yes, very much so. I've been, and we all are, I suppose, have been accused often of denying Ukraine agency in all of this, as you say, a proxy and all the rest. Well, it of course, it's important not to, you know, denigrate the ability of Ukraine to decide. But who decides? And this is exactly the point which I'm thinking absolutely right to raise that. I mean, I've been arguing for many, many years that Ukraine, and that is its wealth and that is its achievement, is made up of many different viewpoints, ideological and indeed, you know, demographically, ethnically, even if you like. And this isn't a negative, it's a plus. And but the catastrophe and the failure has been to institutionalize all of that at the constitutional level. Until recently, you know, language, even though they weren't allowed at schools and education and public life at the private level, it was, you know, allowed, and of course it is today. But it needed to be instantiated in some sort of constitutional settlement, which would then have made all the communities partners in, which would love to see nation and state building in a free, democratic, sovereign Ukraine. But they messed it up big time, in my view. I know this goes against the trend of most Ukrainian experts who buy into a different model of state building, the one pursued in Estonia and Latvia, which again, has undergone much criticism. You can understand the context, of course. But in the Ukraine, the idea of applying that sort of, if you like, remedial state building, okay, we need to go back, we need to get rid of Russian influence, you know, this in the Soviet form or, and imperial form, is just simply a recipe for the disaster which we have today. So, you know, I always ask, we needed this sort of genuine, how can I, pluralism within Ukraine, instead of which we have a monist. And of course, it was reflected in politics. Even today, I saw a statistic not long ago, and Vladimir Ishchenko shows this, that, you know, views on NATO membership have been divided. Views even as late as early 2014, on whether Ukraine should join the European Union or sign up to the association agreement or the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union, that there was still a very large constituency for the latter. And, you know, obviously today it's much smaller with, almost non-existent, one would imagine, in the bits which are not part of Russia. And of course, that is the other major development, which is the referendums and the incorporation of these four regions into the Russian state, which, in my view, has Ukrainized the Russian state as well now, because, again, not derogatory, but simply to say that in softening the borders of Russia today, then there's a possibility of a blowback which may ultimately undermine the very foundations of Russian statehood in the future. And of course, the language for that nowadays is so-called decolonization of within Russia itself. So we're in a moment of incredible, well, let's use the word liminality. Everything is open. And of course, how this could go, you know, could be devastating for Russia. And of course, it is devastating for Ukraine today.
When it comes to these annexations of these four Ukrainian territories by Russia, do you have a sense of what the level of popular support for joining Russia actually is? I gather from what I've read about Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014, that popular support there for joining Russia was pretty overwhelming. I feel confident saying that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. But in terms of these newly annexed territories, is it similar to Crimea, or do you think there's more opposition to Russia there than these results of these referendums might suggest?
You're absolutely right about Crimea. A number of independent and above all German public opinion polling agencies did run, you know, what are considered very respectable opinion polls in Crimea, and it shows a very large majority in favour of what they would call reunification with Russia. So Crimea is a special case, which of course makes the Ukrainian demand to, you know, deoccupy it particularly dangerous. What would they do with the population? And then of the four, we need to distinguish between Lugansk and Donetsk, which of course for the last, since 2014 have been, initially under the control of what would be called autonomists, but then later on separatists. And there, though the vote and the idea support for joining Russia is one of the demands which their leaders have been putting forward for many years. And that's, of course, Sergei Naryshkin, the head of the Russian SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, stumbled on the 21st of February meeting when he said, yes, let's incorporate them. And Putin then said, well, we're not talking about that now. It's just their independence. So one would expect, you know, maybe not as high as the figures, which are clearly inflated, but a significant body of people do want to join Russia because that would mean the payment of pensions, the delivery of services, if we could get to some peacetime situation. However, in Zaporozhye and Kherson, it's very different. It's Ukrainian authorities, Kiev says, it's no more than 5% in support. Russia said something over 90. Both figures are absurd. It's, and I think your intuition is right, we don't know. I mean, but we do know that there is a significant body of opinion which will welcome it. And of course, we do know also a body that will deeply oppose it. So this is the point. It's where there's always been this element of civil war, which at the same time, which has now become an interstate war. So there's these two things going on, which of course, and civil wars are the worst wars because as we saw in former Yugoslavia, and of course the Russian civil war, the savagery involved in a civil war is often surpasses that in an interstate war.
Yeah, and this gets back to my question of earlier in terms of the different identities inside of Ukraine, but one of them we're just not allowed to recognize here in the West, which is the ethnic Russians or people who identify with Russia, who live primarily in the East, who, you know, were the base of support for Yanukovych when he won the presidency, and then were angered when he was ousted back in 2014 in a U.S.-backed uprising or coup, depending on your perspective. And it's those ethnic Russians that we're not really allowed to think about or believe have agency. It's only essentially, as far as I understand the U.S. policies, is we're only supposed to basically be aligned with the nationalist component that is based in the west of Ukraine.
Absolutely. I remember traveling through the Donbass in 2008 and was astonished to see, you know, on, you know, build public buildings, gas holders and the like, NATO net, no to NATO back in 2008, because obviously the promise for NATO membership was in the Bucharest summit in April 2008. So it really led to a very sharp reaction even then, way before all of this. But you're absolutely right. There is a Russophone element there, which, you know, various statistics, we haven't had a census since 2001, but 20% or maybe 18-20% of the population were earlier ethnic Russians. Russian language was prevalent, but at least 60% of the population were fluent and used it in most communications, including Zelensky himself until recently and the leadership. But can I just make, there is this Russophone constituency, but what makes this tragedy even worse is that and this is opinion polls, Kiev Institute, International Institute of Sociology, in late 2013, again in early 2014, showed that even in the Donbass, the demand, the desire was for autonomy, not separation, that the Russophone population were quite, in my view, you know, it's good that they wanted to be part of this sovereign, independent, democratic Ukraine, but they wanted their concerns to be addressed. So it wasn't separatism, it was autonomy. And in a sense, this is what would have been the sensible way forwards, even after the coup, if you want to call it that, or we want to call it that, of February 2014. That they, this is what so astonished so many in the Donbass. They told me this, that when Poroshenko, who was elected in May, but before that, provisional government, launched the anti-terrorist operation, as it was called, against its own people in the Donbass, plus the abuse, calling them Sovoks, delegitimating their national, their identity, their very language, their culture as backward, demodernized, you know, an absolute drag. I mean, this was just extraordinary language, which most people would find unacceptable if we used it about any community in England or the United States, yet it passed without comment by so many in the West. And that takes me back once again to Angela Merkel and her failure to push genuinely for the implementation of Minsk II, which was a way, of course, pushed by Moscow, for that autonomy to be granted within this democratic free Soviet Ukraine. So there was nothing wrong about Minsk II, other than the fact that it may have put a block on NATO enlargement, as if that's the most important thing in the universe, NATO enlargement, which, you know, as far as Ukrainians were concerned, they were divided on this issue. So, you know, again, the West was driving an agenda and not criticizing, and Merkel's failure genuinely to push what, I understand why people didn't want Minsk II and so on, we all know that. But ultimately, it was the rational thing to do. Moscow was pushing these people to go back to Ukraine with a degree of autonomy and their language rights and so on. Well, that's normal. Canada has it. Northern Italy, Alto Adige, has it. We in the United Kingdom have given devolution to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And it's fantastic. Let them develop their cultures, their peoplehood, if you like, nationhood, within the framework of this larger unity. You know, there's all sorts of variable geometry that could have been applied, instead of which we've got this monolithic, monist vision, NATO enlargement, joining the West, and that means turning your back against Russia.
Yes, when these breakaway republics, Donetsk and Luhansk, voted for autonomy back in 2014, I believe it was.
Yes, it was May 2014, if I'm not mistaken, 17th of April.
Russia responded by asking them not to hold those votes and refused to actually recognize them, right? They, you know, wanting to keep those regions
Putin
apart.
Was against it personally. He said, don't do it. And they went ahead with it. So it wasn't as if they were totally puppets in the hand of Moscow, which is the usual way of seeing them.
Recently, Poroshenko, who signed Minsk, made a comment that I think can be interpreted as an admission that he had no intention of actually following Minsk II. He said that it gave us 8 years to delay the war, essentially.
How did the negotiations in Minsk end? We achieved what we wanted. We didn't trust Putin then, and we don't now. Our task was to avert the threat or to delay the war. It was necessary to get 8 years for us to restore economic growth and build up a powerful military. This was the first task, and it was achieved.
What is the result of the Minsk agreement? We win 8 years to create the army. We win 8 years to restore economy.
Who do you fault primarily for the failure of Minsk II, the peace agreement that was reached in 2015 to end the civil war in the Donbass that began the year prior after the U.S.-backed coup with the Maidan? And is there any possible of it being revived today, or is that over?
On the first point, Poroshenko's statement is shocking. But of course, it was only a statement of reality, because they've spent the Ukraine, instead of building a new nation, incorporating these people in the last 7 or 8 years, they were building a war machine. So they built, of course, vast fortifications across the western part of the Donbass. They built up an army. They, instead of building reconciliation, they built war, a war machine with the support of the West. And then, of course, offensive weapons were finally... Obama refused to deliver offensive weapons, and then Trump did, of course. The so-called Putin stooge was the one who was the most militant. So the Putin, as for the who was responsible, Zelensky, of course, as we know, was elected in 2019 with 73% as a peace candidate. He said he would try to implement. And of course, at the beginning, he did. He met with Putin in December that year within the format of the Normandy 4 in France. And so, but then, of course, even as he was meeting It was the anti-capitulation movement within Ukraine. Those are the guys who have taken the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian people hostage. These are many people from Galicia, the western part, but not only, of course, the militants, the so-called, what we used to be known as the Azov Battalion, the militants from the Maidan, of course, who basically seized, and they've been as some sort of extra governmental power, which has acted as a veto player. And it was that veto player which the West should have negated. And this is why I fault Angela Merkel, because obviously she took the lead in the most powerful European nation, and the United States was not part of the Normandy format overseeing the implementation of Minsk II of February 2015, which put an end to the most savage stage of the fighting. So it was, I actually personally do fault Merkel, because she never managed to solve issues. She managed to push them down the road, or then, as it were, take advantage of it at a certain moment. And it was just simply by default, the situation only became aggravated. And so when the explosion came, it took all the more devastating form as we see today.
Vladimir Putin has just recently given a speech at an annual foreign policy conference. What stood out to you about what he said?
This is his speech, which he gave on the 27th of October to the Valdai International Discussion Club, which, as always, first of all, I mean, there's many things that, first of all, in purely physical terms, all the, I don't know about the US press, but the British media have been, there's been a lot of talk about the fact he's ill, he's terminally ill, he's weak and so on. He was in fine form. So he's 70 years old and he's still physically in good shape, and just mentally in extremely good shape. I mean, just simply technically. Second, the speech rehearsed the usual litany of grievances. Or that's certainly how the Western media put it. It was a considered, thoughtful speech which recapitulated the fundamental Russian argument at the end of the Cold War. And the argument is one which he's been making, but one which even independent academics and scholars have been making in the West, is that we needed that a unipolar world, that a one-dimensional world, a world in which just sees the expansion of NATO, and as I call it, of the political West, is inevitably going to meet pushback in Russia and in China, to a lesser degree in India, Indonesia. It's always had a pushback in Mexico, by the way, in all sorts of ways, including the present leadership. So it's not something amazing and astonishing that this is happening. And his speech gave a considered defense of, if you like, resistance to this sort of unipolar world. That's how he talked about multipolarity. In a more philosophical, if you like, conceptual sense, what we're talking about here and what his whole speech reacted to was this expansion of a political West. The Russians use the term collective West, and he used that term. But a political West is more specific. It's the political West that took shape during the Cold War, Cold War I, and which was shaped by the Cold War, that instead of being dismantled at the end of Cold War after 1989, instead went on the offensive, and quite explicitly, I mean, in a ideological sense. And of course, it then met the resistance, which it has done, of course, in Russia, China, and elsewhere. So the speech was a restatement. And so those Western analysts who glibly dismiss it as the usual Russian litany of grievances, it's the sort of things he's been saying for years. But it was a very fine summary. So I think, it's really useful for people to read it and have a look at it and actually then make up their own minds instead of the way it is interpreted by most Western commentators.
Recently, there was a report in Politico that the U.S. is speeding up plans to store upgraded nukes in Europe. The transfer of an improved gravity bomb has been moved up to earlier than planned in purported response to Russia's actions in Ukraine. What is your assessment of the threat of nuclear war? And it's widely reported here in the West that Putin has threatened to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. He tried to clarify that in his speech this week, saying that Russia has no need to use nuclear weapons. where do you stand on this issue, on, you know, the level of threat that we're in, and what Putin has actually said so far when it comes to his willingness to use nuclear weapons?
Certainly, the level of danger today is as high as it's ever been, possibly higher than even the Cuban Missile Crisis 60 years ago, because the situation could develop and evolve in many different ways. There are some, there's been an excellent compendium of all that Putin has said on the nuclear issue. And time and again, the threat has always been implicit, even though Western commentators have misconstrued it to say it has been explicit. And it's not just Putin, but many senior Russian leaders are insisting there is no question, and including, for example, the Anatoly Antonov, the Russian ambassador to the US, to say that it is inconceivable and it goes against Russia's nuclear doctrine to use a nuclear weapon, including tactical ones in Ukraine. And it doesn't make sense anyway. The Russian nuclear doctrine says it'll be used only if there's an existential danger to the Russian state, that is, in danger of collapse. But of course, now that these four regions plus Crimea are now part of Russia, that defensive doctrine has now been pushed forwards. So the question then becomes, if Ukraine is in danger of taking Kherson, Zaporozhye, Lugansk, and Donetsk, as well as Crimea, at that point, all the bets are off the table. But I think you're absolutely right. The West has misconstrued Russia's... What Putin actually also in 2014 alluded to the nuclear issue as not so much a direct threat, but as a sort of warning that this is what it may come to if Russia's red lines are ignored. And of course, Russia's red lines have been ignored consistently for the last 8 years. But it was a sort of sense, don't you guys think of using nuclear weapons against us? So this talk of Russia using nuclear blackmail and all the rest must be, as you say, put very much in context. So we're running a fine line here between saying, well, everything is fine, because if we're saying everything is fine, then the escalation and ignoring Russia's red lines becomes all the more dangerous. Oh, Russia's just saber-rattling. It doesn't mean it. Therefore, we can go ahead and give Ukraine even more powerful weapons, even more of them, perhaps impose a no-fly zone. Who knows where it could go and such like. So Russia's is just empty words. So it's a fine line, as always with nuclear issues. There's an element of strategic ambiguity. So it behooves us all, and the leaders, that is, to take the threat seriously and to ensure we don't go to that threshold. Because once even tactical nuclear weapons, until this time, the United States had about 195, just under 200 of these tactical nuclear weapons stored in Germany, Holland, and so on. There's even talk, by the way, just in addition, while we're talking about this, that there is even talk now of nuclear weapons in Finland, which is the height of strategic madness. It's almost inconceivable that this talk even should take place. So it's not Russia which is escalating the nuclear issues. It's both sides, to be honest. And so, as in Cuban crisis 60 years ago, both sides need to step back.
Right now in the U.S., there is a major controversy over congressional progressives issuing a letter nicely asking Biden to pursue diplomacy with Russia, not threatening to withhold any of the military spending that they've been approving unanimously since the start of Russia's invasion, now more than $66 billion, I believe. Just asking him, saying, hey, while we're waging this proxy war, can you at least talk to Russia and try to negotiate a ceasefire and a peaceful settlement? And that provoked an outrage among war hawks in Washington. And within 24 hours, it was withdrawn. Observing this from across the pond, I'm wondering your thoughts on this episode.
Yeah, it was absolutely extraordinary. And of course, this has prompted a lot of discussion about the genuine radicalism of the Quad and all of this progressive. I think it's about 100 deputies involved in that whole progressive democratic movement. And it just shows a sort of the weakness. And of course, it's reproduced here in the Labour Party and our leader, Keir Starmer, who has said that membership or anti-NATO position is incompatible with Labour Party membership, which negates the long tradition of a peace movement and anti-militarist movement within our socialist and Labour movement in the UK. But of course, the larger issue is that, again, this is a symptom of the Ukrainization of our language, that in Ukraine, as we know, and as to my cost, is that so many issues are off the board and off the table. And those who dare, even tentatively, and in this very mild manner, as you say, put forward that, look, guys, wouldn't it be sensible to open channels of communication to talk? In the Cuban Missile Crisis, precisely, it was dialogue that helped us overcome it. And there was no sense that, you know, it was appeasement to talk to Khrushchev. But, of course, the demonization of Putin today has reached such extraordinary levels. This is why, you know, his speech yesterday was interesting just for the physical side of it, to show this guy is not irrational, he's not mad, he's not a demon, he's not the devil. You know, we may disagree with him fundamentally, but that doesn't mean to say you can't talk with him. The whole point of diplomacy is to overcome precisely difference. It's no good talking just to your friends, but that is a reflection of the way that the political West after the Cold War has become increasingly hermetic. That means closed. It is closed to outside influence. And that's why today, and that's a different topic, but why today it's escalating immeasurably a conflict with China. Now, China, you could have criticism of all sorts of its policies, but the sort of language and the way it's going today is something which is not necessary. And so, but another issue of this Ukrainization is the consistent attacks, even by Ukrainian leftists, against peace movements, anti-militarist movements. But this, in my view, makes it all the more important for those of us in the anti-militarist and, you know, stop the war type movements, our anti-war movements, to provide a strong conceptual and theoretical framework which is ethically balanced. So it doesn't mean appeasement. It precisely means the opposite, because appeasement, to say to Moscow, why not talk of appeasement to Washington? That's, you know, what's goose sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. So it's an equal balance. I think that there's theoretical work that does need to be done to establish an ethical position and to fight back against this extraordinary militarization of political discourse, where even tentative things, and unfortunately, this also applies to the European Union, which, as I said earlier, we always believed that it was a movement for peace and reconciliation. And it's now becoming increasingly militarized language. You know, and again, it's not just Ukraine. It's the Poles, the Baltic republics have seized the agenda. And what we used to call in the good old days of the Iraq War, not the war was good, but 2003, old Europe versus new Europe. Well, one of the results of this is that, you know, it's not even peace movements. It's the sensible powers, Germany, France, Italy, which in the past would have taken a lead. We have Macron all the time saying sensible things. Why is Macron's diplomatic initiatives failing to gain any traction? And that's, again, a phenomenon. What has happened with the European Union and the intensification of so-called NATO solidarity, the consolidation of the West, is that it has depowered sensible countries, well, sensible in inverted commas, France, Germany, and Italy. It's depowered them. They've succumbed to this general hysteria, to the new Europe's complete, you know, they have capitulated, in my view, to this militarism, to this hawkishness. And of course, they now try to use the collective West, the political West, to amplify and their historical grievances, which are genuine, of course they are, but to amplify them and then to use them as retribution to the old enemy in Moscow. So it's a cycle that really, we would have hoped that letter, that gentle letter calling for opening a dialogue, would have had more resonance, instead of which, as you say, they quickly and, in my view, disgracefully backtracked and effectively apologized. They had nothing to apologize about.
As we wrap, Richard Sakwa, it seems to me that we're in a much more dangerous phase of the Ukraine war. Russia has recently escalated its attacks on civilian infrastructure, knocking out energy grids and water supply, something that it I think it's fair to say it avoided doing earlier in the conflict. And Russia's also mobilized 300,000 troops, if not more. Where do you see this war going, and what are your main concerns as we head into the winter?
Well, indeed. At the moment, there's a bit of a hiatus. As I say, big battles going on in Bakhmut and elsewhere in Kherson. But the actual battlefield situation could change radically. So Russia has not yet mobilized much of its forces. One statistic, I say again, whether it's true or not, I don't know, suggested that Russia has actually only deployed 20 to 30% maximum of its potential military capacity. And Putin's strategy was, until recently, to, as it were, insulate the Russian public, to insulate this war, to, as it were, bracket it, let life go on as normal. But of course, what we've now been moving for, this partial mobilization on the 21st of September, has demonstrated, and of course, the backlash within Russia and the establishment last week of two executive committees, one under the government, one under the State Council, to shift towards a military, a mobilized economy. So, as all military experts have been arguing for the last 20-odd years, in a conflict with the political West, Russia has got the mobilizational potential because it's next door. So it's got the escalation dominance is the language I think they used. And now we're beginning to see it's slow. Russia usually begins wars rather badly. You know, it just throws things in, as the Russians say, na avoz. You know, let's see how it goes. And clearly this war began like this. Now they're settling down for a serious campaign. So this is no longer a special military operation. It will become a war. And this is why you, me, we've all been calling for ceasefires, so some sort of peace negotiations, because this is just the beginning. And the suffering of the Ukrainian people will immeasurably increase, sadly, appallingly. And that's what I have tried to stop. We've all been trying to stop this escalation, instead of which the hawks, the warmongers in London and Washington and sadly Brussels today have led to a situation. It's just beginning. Russia cannot lose this war. I mean, all military planners have been saying this for 20 years. NATO said it all the way back from its foundation, because it's next door. It cannot win this war. I mean, it will not win this war. No one is going to win this war. Everyone will lose. Russia will suffer enormously. Its economy is being damaged. Its society is being damaged. The human losses are appalling. And yet, the language of peace cannot find an adequate expression. And, you know, social movements, why aren't thousands out on the streets calling for this, to support those people who signed that rather tame letter, instead of which they backtracked? So it's exceptional, but we're only at the beginning. This is a slow motion Cuban missile crisis. And, you know, it's impossible to predict how it's going to go, but apart from that, it's going to get worse before it may get even worse.
Richard Sakwa, professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent. His books include Frontline Ukraine and his latest Deception, Russiagate and the New Cold War. Richard Sakwa, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thanks.